So we're speaking about heat conduction today. And since I skipped the chapter with Wiener processes, this is now chapter 6. I divided this chapter into two parts. One part where I want to speak about how we find the model, which in the end is a partial differential equation, and then how to solve this partial differential equation with different numerical schemes. And I think today I will concentrate on how, with which principles we find this partial differential equation, which is an example for all kinds of diffusion processes. So giving this the name of the topic heat conduction is kind of just taking one example for which this is a good model and not kind of giving it a meta name under which you could collect all kinds of things. Maybe it's also good because while doing the model, I would, of course, like to induce certain pictures in your head, and this is easier with having a specific enough example. So let's stick with heat conduction for the moment. But of course, just as a introductory remark, this is, of course, a prototypical thing for all kinds of processes where things are distributed by diffusion. So this means there's not really a transport process where material is transported, but there is kind of an interaction of molecules, for example, where properties like the temperature or the energy of the material is transported through the material. And from a physical point of view, and kind of also from the mathematical point of view, we think of that as being a stochastic process where you have something like a Brownian motion in the background. So the small movement of small particles where energy can be redistributed in the material. But you will see that in our macroscopic model, you won't see anything on the stochastics because it's a model where we just use our mean values of the processes which are stochastic and which are quantities where we can really measure things. Because that's important that we find quantities which we can measure in order to make our model comparable to experiments. Of course, there are a lot of applications even for the heat conduction. So, for example, if you want to model everything about, so here I have refrigerators and air conditioning. So everything where you want to have a certain temperature, either cold or warm, you will have to work with heat conduction because, of course, for example, for air conditioning, you could say you also have kind of inflow, forced flow, which goes much over, having only as the only process the heat conduction process. It should be a flow process, which we will tackle as in the next chapter. But whenever you have been under such an air conditioning, you know that it's not really comfortable to be in the inflow of either cold or hot air. And so it's much better if you manage to regulate everything that you can just use heat conduction as the process which we want to model today and not take a flow in order to push this process faster. So our applications here are refrigerator and air conditioning and also sometimes air conditioning. And sometimes you just use this, for example, for air conditioning, not for the complete model, but for parts of the models. For example, whenever you want to make air conditioning models for buildings, you will have to take into account what's happening on the boundaries of rooms. And one important boundary are windows. And on the windows, you have inflow of energy when there is sunshine outside. And this would much more be a chapter of heat conduction you will have to put into your model than a flow process. Of course, there could be a flow process on the inside of the window, which is triggered by the energy which is introduced through this boundary value. But in order to have a model for this boundary condition, you would use parts of the heat conduction process, which we want to discuss today. Okay, so how to model that? And also the way how I will present this modeling process is a prototypical modeling process, because what I will do, just to have an idea, I will take a kind of an example volume, or you could also think of this as being a small volume. Doesn't really make a difference in the modeling process. And I will prescribe the main physical processes for this volume, which we just taken as an example. And then I will do certain limits for that. And in the end, I have an equation, because since the volume is any volume, not a special one, there are two arguments. One argument is it should be true for the volume, even if I make the volume as small as I want. So the limiting process would be to shrink the volume to some point, and then you have some condition which should be fulfilled at any point, which you can consider as a limiting process of a volume going to zero. And the other way to do kind of the same thing but with different arguments is if I can choose any volume and I have to have the conditions fulfilled, which I write down as an equation, then the condition should not be only valid for kind of integral values over the small, or this kind of exemplary volume. But it's the only possibility to have this true for all volumes is that it's true pointwise. And so in both arguments, you end up with a pointwise equation. And this works really well for processes like, for example, heat conduction, also for flow processes, which we will treat as a next step, because everything which is happening there is a smooth process. So, of course, as a mathematician, we would have to work on that the limiting process is okay, nothing bad can happen, but we can really do that, because the underlying physical process, all the quantities are smooth enough that we can really interchange certain limits in the process. And of course, in the observable physical world, most of the processes are smooth enough in order to have these arguments in place and to work with these arguments. So the physical process, so maybe I just put this as main physical process, which is responsible for the heat conduction, is what we call Brownian motion. And it's kind of funny because this is already so much into all our education and in the imagery which we have of the atomic level or molecular level, that we really have the feeling that we know what's that. But whenever you really have a look at what's happening on the small scale, you already see that also this is kind of just a model for what's really there, because, of course, it's much more complex than we could think of the particles as being just particles. And the thing which is always astounding to me is that, in a way, all the material is made out of stuff where in almost 100% of the places there is nothing. Yeah, and so to get your head around this is kind of a complicated thing, because in the world which we see on a macroscopic level, everything is kind of things which we can really touch and which takes up space and things like that. And this is made up out of stuff which there is almost nothing. Whenever you would just choose one place on a microscopic level, you would probably point to something where there is nothing. Nevertheless, we think of the molecules, for example, in air or in a slowly moving liquid, as moving around freely enough for having this Brownian motion where energy can distribute it among the molecules. So in a way, the mathematical theory behind that would be stochastics or stochastic processes. And for example, if we would really like to work with this on a molecular level, we would start out with as an easiest model with something like random walk models. So, and in random walk, the most famous examples are the ones where you have either small animals or drunken persons which decide at certain points of their way to go one way or another with just a certain probability, for example, just one half if you have two possibilities. And this is on a small scale and on a scale where already children can have fun with that. The idea behind the Brownian motion. Of course, in order to really work with that as a measure and something where we can really integrate on mean value scale, we should work a little bit more about the mathematics. But I think the most important is to get the idea, because then it's also easier to grasp what the mathematics is about, which one to put this into integrals with which you can work and measures and things like that. And also which makes it clear what kind of limits are okay and which kind of limits can produce funny stuff. So we have to choose one quantity, which is the quantity for which we want to have an equation. So maybe I put here choose physical quantity. Sorry, there was an H missing. Physical quantity. And of course, this looks a bit funny when speaking about heat conduction, because it's almost obvious that we will choose the temperature. But temperature. And this is almost obvious because that's the only quantity where we have simple ways to measure it. On the other hand, it's more about a certain equilibrium or kind of a process where we have to keep the energy on the same level. So we could also say that we are choosing parts of the energy for our equation. And indeed, it's the case that if you want to write models for fluid flow, very often it's much easier to do that, keeping the energy in your model and only switching to temperature on the very last step. But of course, here it's okay, as an introductory chapter, that we just stick with the temperature. And we have enough experience from our everyday life, even being mathematicians and maybe not being exposed to experiments and documenting of experiments during our study course, that we have an idea how temperature is behaving. So I will call the temperature capital T, of course, because of the first letter, but the small t will be used for time. So our temperature depends on a point in space, which I will write like that for the moment, and time. So x vectorial for space and t for time, the small t. And we want to find a partial differential equation for the evolution of the temperature. And in a way, you could think of the evolution as being in space or in time, and of course in both as well together. But the model behind that is more a model of a temporal distribution. So you start with an initial condition for some initial time, which of course is connected to a temperature distribution in space for this initial time. And then you are interested in the development of the temperature values at all points in space which you observe over a certain time interval. So the connection between the temperature and the Brownian motion, which we think as being the process behind heat conduction, is that we can interpret temperature as the mean oscillation velocity of the particles. So this is, I will use this symbol, so this is in principle temperature is the same as the mean oscillation velocity of the particles. And of course with particles I mean either atoms or molecules. And I'm writing that because that's kind of a classical idea to think about temperature. On the other hand, of course, there's also a lot of discussion under which constraints this is really true, because, of course, in a classical setting, it's okay to do that, and the mathematics and physics behind that is done, so we can really use that. But, of course, there are a lot of interesting cases where temperature goes kind of to the boundaries of what we can do, very cold or very hot, where the material changes its properties, and then doing just that is a bit too rough. But for today, it's okay. And this is kind of the connection between the equation, which we will write down for the temperature with the help of macroscopic observations, and the microscopic process, which we know is driving our macroscopic observations. So in a way, you can also compare this to the things which we did for traffic flow, because we started out to model traffic on a macroscopic level just using our observations, so just observing certain main properties of traffic and putting this into a model and then asking the model certain kind of not too complicated questions. On the other hand, of course, you know that traffic is made from the cars or the persons or the bicycles moving. So you have something like this motion of particles, which is kind of the process behind. And you always have the feeling that if you want to make this more precise or a better model for more applications, you would have to go back to really use this microscopic level. And then you need a way to go from temperature to the Brownian motion or from the Brownian motion to the temperature. And in this case, this is done via this interpretation of temperature as being the mean oscillation of the velocity in the particles. Okay, so I was speaking about the main idea, choosing just one volume. So now I will put this picture on the blackboard. So in order to have an equation, we think of a small body with a certain volume, capital V. And in order to have it something happening, we have a temperature T1 inside this volume, and we have a temperature T2 outside the volume. And of course, I'm just writing it this way because the only important property for the moment is that they differ, because if they wouldn't differ, nothing would happen. You already know that. And it's not important if the temperature T1, for example, is a constant temperature. It could also be a temperature distribution which depends on the space. I'm not writing that down for the moment because I want to. So the most important information is that T1 and T2 are different ones. That's why they get different names. So if I have, for example, that this is a higher temperature, so if T2 is bigger than T1, and of course in writing this, it's easier to check when they are really constant temperatures. So maybe it's enough to take them just as constants for the moment. Then we know, due to the second law of thermodynamics, that the higher temperature from the outside will, so energy from the outside will be transferred to the inside of this body and the temperature inside will grow. And maybe I just put this as an arrow here. So in order to have some logic on the blackboard, maybe I just make an arrow also from the second law of thermodynamics to the arrow, which is the energy transfer from outside to the inside. And of course, maybe I just use a different color, not to make it too complicated. If the inner temperature would be higher, then of course this arrow would be pointed in the opposite direction. So, and this is just using your everyday experience about processes, yes. And if I'm saying second law of thermodynamics, of course, this is putting your everyday experience on a scientific level. And I don't really know which persons in the audience ever heard of the second law of thermodynamics. Not so many hands are going up. Because the thing is kind of, in a way, there are concerning energy, there are two things which are believed to be true on an axiomatic level. So you can't really prove it, but all the observations point towards the fact that we have kind of energy is conserved. And, you know, whenever you have kind of things contradicting that, the outcome is that you didn't really consider all the possible forms of energy. So if you put together all the forms of energy, then all the energy should stay in the system as long as the system is isolated and there is no possibility to redistribute energy with the help of kind of outside things. Nevertheless, conservation of energy doesn't really explain why we have this energy flow when we have higher temperature and lower temperature. And especially it doesn't explain that there is only one direction of this energy transfer which we observe. So we always observe that if we have higher temperature, then this is distributed in the direction that kind of all the system gets a lower temperature from this part which has the higher temperature. So there's really kind of a direction of the gradient, you could say, in mathematical terms. And this is put into this so-called second law of thermodynamics. And so this is kind of the first rough observation for that. So whenever you have a temperature difference, the system tries to redistribute the energy in a way that afterwards you have the same temperature, which is somewhere between this lowest and the highest point, which you had at the very beginning, and giving this a certain direction. On the other hand, it's really complicated to formulate the second law of thermodynamics in a way that all the scientists can agree. So you have a lot of discussions about what is the right way to really formulate it in a way that you don't have contradictions in that. And it's kind of interesting to see these discussions as an outsider, so as a mathematician, you know, I just see what they are discussing inside physical science. And because sometimes it's really necessary for my models to start with these first principles and then to, for example, to assume that the viscosity is positive is kind of obvious because I can't really attribute anything which I observe in physics to some viscosity which would be negative. But if I have more complicated materials where I have properties which I don't really have some experiences from everyday life, sometimes I draw from second law of thermodynamics that certain parameters have to be either positive or negative, or their sum has to be positive, something like that. And so I really need this second law of thermodynamics. I can't ignore it. But depending on the formulation of that, sometimes you get kind of opposite results on these signs in front of coefficients in mathematical models, which kind of can't be true for something which is on an axiomatic level. So this should be kind of true. And so it's kind of a funny thing to be at conferences and then someone starting the lecture with, "I believe in the second law of thermodynamics in the following form," and then writing it down in order to have the coefficients in a certain way and then to draw mathematical conclusions from that. Okay, here it's kind of obvious, but in general it's not so obvious how we can formulate the second law of thermodynamic without having inner discussions with the model. And one explanation for that, which I find really fascinating, is that probably this is really strongly connected to the fact that we also have our observation of time being working only in one direction. So in a way, the problem with the second law of thermodynamic is the one that we can really reverse time. Of course, there you already, you know, there are discussions on a scientific level. It might be possible with a lot of energy and, you know, bending the space and whatever. But there you already see that it really is connected to the formulation. Yeah. So in our everyday experience, we can't reverse time. And it sounds really very improbable if someone wants to convince us that in certain conditions it might be possible. And the second law of thermodynamics has the same problem, that probably we need another 40 years or something to dance around it, that we, in the end, we have formulation which is really the one which is the right one, so that we are on the right abstract level to formulate it. Okay, so, but nevertheless, we really wouldn't need it that strongly, because I could just draw my model by all of you. Whenever you do these experiments, you observe that energy is transferred from the higher temperature to the lower temperature. The thing which is kind of making this more precise, or restricting this, or trying to put this on a level where we can really make a model from that in the way that we have an equation in the end, is that we say that this process of exchanging energy is really a process which is firstly restricted to this boundary here. So it's something which is happening on the boundary. And the boundary should have a name. I call it partial V, because that's a usual abbreviation among mathematicians for all boundaries. So whenever we have a domain, very often it gets the name omega, then the boundary of that domain is partial, and then the name of the domain. And so here we have the volume, which on my blackboard, of course, is a two-dimensional thing and not a three-dimensional thing, what the volume should be. And then we consider the boundary of the volume, so kind of the surface of our body, and we call it partial V. And the second thing, so maybe I just write this down in order to make this more precise. So we make kind of axioms. So the transfer happens only on the boundary. This is the first one. And the second one is that the transfer always takes the shortest way, which means it's going normal through the boundary. So it's a normal direction. Maybe I just, yeah, I call the boundary also in my axioms. So, and with my arrows, you already see that I kind of was already in the spirit of making this arrow perpendicular to my surface. So we think of this being really perpendicular to the direction which is the normal direction on the point of the surface where we want to study the exchange of energy. So for the simplest model, we will use the density of our material, because that's a thing which we can bring into the change of temperature in our volume. And we will choose a density which is homogeneous. So maybe I just put this here. A simplest model says that all quantities are homogeneous. So here the opposite of this would be to assume that it's heterogeneous, so you have different properties at different points, but here we want to have the same properties at all points. And this is especially related to the density of the material. And again, the density will be called rho. Then it is related to the heat capacity, which I will call C. And it's a spatial property. Okay. It's kind of funny to fill a blackboard with a lot of very elementary observations and then to end up with a kind of complicated equation. But, so of course we use conservation properties, and here we use conservation of mass and energy. So maybe I'm just vague here, use conservation properties. So for example, we can calculate the heat Q by taking the integral over our volume, so integral over V of the density multiplied with the heat capacity and the temperature. And then, of course, integral is over all points in our volume, so over x. And the change in this heat is triggered by a heat transfer over the boundary. This is what I was kind of putting as an axiom there. So heat transfer is across the boundary and triggered by the temperature difference. In normal direction. And if we want to write that mathematically, we have two possibilities. We can really use the symbol partial n for the temperature, which would be a normal, so-called normal derivative of the temperature. But I think it's easier to write that as kind of using the definition of that. So what we do is we take the gradient of the temperature. Temperature is a scalar quantity with the gradient in front. It's a vector now. And we multiply this vector with the normal direction. And so we get a scalar quantity from that. So I'm using an arrow connecting the symbol vectorial n with the normal direction in order to introduce this notation. And we do not only need the heat capacity in order to have this so kind of the energy which is measured as the heat inside the volume, but of course we also need kind of the, I could say, velocity or acceleration of, or the possibility how fast heat can be exchanged. And this is measured as the so-called heat conductivity. And this gets different names. I will use a small k here, heat conductivity of material. And of course, this should be positive. And in order to have the simplest model, we will consider this to be constant. Also, in a way, we would need very complicated materials in order to have really different heat conductivity at different circumstances, which would happen at different base points. So heat conductivity to be constant is kind of a safe assumption, I would say. Okay, so what can we do with our conserved quantity together with this heat transfer? We can say that the change in heat over time, so the derivative of the heat with respect to time, can only be triggered by this temperature difference over this normal derivative of the temperature on the boundary, which means it should be the integral over the boundary of the heat conductivity parameter K multiplied with the normal derivative of T. So we take here the gradient of T as a quantity in X and T multiplied with the normal direction. And in general, this is a three-dimensional object, so we would integrate over a two-dimensional object, which is the surface. And in German, we call this, for example, DO, for the German word Oberfläche, for surface. Of course, you could say then in English we can call it DS, but that's kind of cheatery, because in German we have DS for line integrals, which is not the surface. So whatever you want to use, just use it. So for example, it would be also safe to write here dx, because that it's a surface is already encoded in the domain on which we want to integrate. Okay, now we really know that we can't avoid to write this integral over the surface, because the surface is where the main process is happening for our modeling. But we don't really feel comfortable in using surface information for writing down an equation for the temperature in the end. So we would much prefer to have an information which is an information on the volume, not on the surface of the volume. And we are lucky that this is always possible for volumes with very low regularity assumptions. We can always use the Gauss theorem, which relates this normal transport of a quantity to the divergence of the quantity in the volume. So what we can do, and we already did this also for the traffic, so you see this already for the second time in our lecture, so we can write this with the help of the Gauss theorem as integral over the volume. Then we have still the K. Of course, I could put the K in front of the integral. Whenever I would really try to calculate the integral, I will always put it in front of it, because it's just a constant quantity. I'm not really doing it here, because, you know, in the end, I will get rid of this integral sign. And then the thing which we'll calculate from what's here below the integral will remain. And so it's safer to have the K here and not in front of the integral, in order not to lose it errorly to doing a mistake. So what we have is that according to the Gauss theorem, we can replace this with the divergence of our quantity, which is the gradient of T in the normal, not the gradient of T, dx. And we can rewrite that. Just have to do it once, and then you keep that in mind as a rule, that this is nothing else than the Laplacian. Of course, on the other hand, if we have this change of the heat in our volume over time, then we can use this definition here and get that this is nothing else than the integral over the volume. Then we have our heat capacity C multiplied with the rho, so the density, and then the change in the temperature, which here is a partial derivative with respect to time of T. So on the one hand, so here we are kind of using our definition of heat, which is a physical definition, and just calculate the change in time, and it reads like that. And in our first formula, we use that we know that the process changing the heat is a process which is related to the temperature difference on the boundary. Nevertheless, since both are equal to the change of the heat, they have to be the same. So what we get is that the integral over our volume, where we integrate over C rho, the change in time of t, has to be the same as the integral over our volume with the heat capacity k and the Laplacian of t. Maybe I should write dx here in order to be correct. So now we have kind of a balance, which is always true. And here we have the point which I was already pointing to from the very beginning, that of course the balance is already a nice model to work with, but it gets even nicer if we can make a pointwise relation from that, which means we, by arguing that we can do this balance for all volumes, no matter how they look, the only condition is that they should be smooth enough in order that the Gauss theorem is true. Or we could also argue that we could let our example volume go to zero in a nice way. Then we get from this balance, which is true for all volumes, a pointwise relation, which has to be true, which reads that C rho partial derivative of t has to be the same as k multiplied with the Laplacian of t. And we have three quantities here which are not the temperature, C, rho, and k. And of course it reads much nicer if we combine them to have the equation that the change, the temporal change in t, so partial derivative with respect to time of our temperature, is equal to k over c rho, Laplacian of t. And we will call this new parameter, which is kind of a combination of a lot of material properties, as a kappa. So it's Greek K. And I will take yellow to put this into a yellow box because this is our model which we wanted to find. And this model is called heat equation. Of course, in a way, most mathematicians go through their education and meet the heat equation as kind of one of the classical parabolic equations, and it's just written down, so without really giving it any particular reason to be there. We did something different because I wanted to give a reason why we end up with this equation. But of course, now after we have the equation, we should look at it from a mathematical point of view in order to decide if this is kind of a good equation for our problem. Of course, we are kind of trustful because we followed classical steps and we are not the first one to do that. Nevertheless, of course, it's good to have a view on the heat equation in order to discuss this as a model. Okay, so if we have the heat equation, of course, in order to really to have it as a configuration in which we can solve it, we should add the necessary conditions. So we need boundary conditions on the surface of the domain in which we want to calculate. So maybe I should take here a different name for our domain in which we want to calculate the heat equation. So I call it here omega. So here you want to solve the heat equation in omega. And so from the mathematical point of view, we would just say we have to add the boundary conditions in order that we have a well-defined problem. Yeah, because, you know, these are degrees of freedom which have to be settled in order to have just one possible solution. But, of course, from a physical point of view, prescribing these boundary conditions is also part of the model. So, for example, if you would like to have this solution of the heat equation for a room where temperature is redistributing itself, then you would have to choose different boundary conditions for where windows are and where there is a wall. And you could even have something like an inflow condition if there is an open door, something like that. So for the moment, we don't really think about this, but because we are a modeling lecture, I want to point at least here once that, of course, prescribing this boundary condition is also part of the model. And it's really not so clear. In general, we are choosing very often boundary conditions which are just mathematically easy. And when finding results which don't look like we expect them to be, then very often it's a problem with the boundary conditions. Of course, then we also have to add an initial temperature distribution. Initial temperature. And we need the good or correct value for kappa. And also here it might be a bit too simplifying to think of kappa as being a constant, because it's kind of safe to assume that heat conductivity, the C in this constant here, is really a constant. And even this K, which was the C was the heat capacity and the K is the heat conductivity. So these both, for very many materials which we really have in our everyday life, they are safe to be considered constants. But for example, the density is probably not a constant at all. And so through the density, we would have at least something which is depending on the point which is here inside our domain omega. So it could be a different. So the kappa could be a function of space, and it could also be a function of time. Space is more probable than time. So, sorry. So maybe I put this here as in general, it is too rough to take it constant. So constant density is very often considered a good approximation for materials which are not very much compressible, at least not compressible under forces which are kind of really like pressure. If you have changes in the temperature, of course, it should kind of react to that, because otherwise we can't really redistribute temperature if we don't allow for density to vary at least a bit. But nevertheless, maybe I should make both comments here. So in general, it is too rough to take it constant, but it does not vary too much for classical applications. And so under the kind of assumption that we do a lot of mistakes in our modeling process anyway, because we can't do better than kind of assume what we observe, which is kind of rough, then we are just adding another error in putting kappa to be almost constant and using it like a constant. Of course, mathematically speaking, this is really interesting because it's easier for us to develop a theory, solvability theory for that, if we really consider this coefficient in front of the Laplacian to be a constant. And we have to develop different tools if we allow this one to vary in space. Mathematically, this is mostly related to the fact that our mathematical tools very often use that this Laplacian can be written as the divergence of the gradient. And so we can use tools which highly benefit from the fact that we have this right-hand side as a divergence of something. But if we have this function in front of it, we can't put this under the divergence, so we lose this possibility to use this elegant tools which apply this divergence form. So mathematically, this is not so nice if we have to have kappa varying too much. But of course, even here, mathematics copies kind of physics. If we can put our kappa with minimal and maximal values in some small enough interval, we can do something treating as almost like a constant. And so we can copy what we do in our modeling process, considering kappa to be not varying too much, into our mathematical theory. So now I'm just checking if I didn't forget anything here. Yeah. Okay. There are several possibilities to go on from here. Of course, what I didn't really put on the blackboard up to now is the fact that the heat equation is a parabolic equation. This refers to the names of partial differential equations we are used to give as mathematicians. And here we just have a look at the highest order derivatives which exist in space and time, and compare them in their numbers. And in general, we have elliptic, parabolic, and hyperbolic equations. Up to now, we only had one elliptic equation in our lecture, which was the transport equation. And I already told you that this is kind of the sort of equations we like the least because they are difficult to treat. On the other hand, they are maybe the most interesting ones. Parabolic equations are kind of intermediate, and very often what's really done is, maybe I just copy it here. It's easier than distance is a bit too much. So we have this parabolic equation change in time of our temperature is equal to some proportional constant and then the Laplacian of T. And so on an abstract level, what's very often is done is to kind of consider this as an evolution problem in time. And we can have something happening here on the right-hand side, which is kind of an abstract operator in the right spaces, so in a frame of spaces, and consider this as being like an ordinary differential equation in time. So, of course, we call this not ordinary differential equation because it's not an ordinary one. We call this evolution equation for the temperature in time. And this is kind of an abstract ODE in time. So what we like to do is we like to copy ideas which we have from ordinary differential equation, like Picard construction, only that now we have to introduce this abstract operators as things which are happening on the right-hand side. And so there is a whole industry of schools in mathematics which have different ways of treating abstract operators in different frames, all starting from this Laplacian, because this is kind of the simplest one, and making this more and more complicated. Of course, on the other hand, you could also say that, you know, these are just derivatives in space, and this is just a derivative in time. So you could take numerical schemes, which are just, you know, they exist for variables, right, to make a distinctions between time and space, and use them and write down a numerical scheme, which always ends up with a huge linear system for the approximations for your temperature in different points in your domain. And this is, of course, always possible. But in order to really prove that this big system is always solvable with a unique solution, and that whenever you make the distance between the points as small as you wish, so that you kind of try to get your approximation better and better by choosing the points nearer and nearer to each other, and we call this convergence of the numerical scheme, then you will need properties of your equation in order to really prove that the numerical scheme works well. And then you very often come back to that it's more comfortable to really make a difference between the time and the space variables. Of course, on the other hand, there is always something like people started to treat elliptic problems firstly, because they were the most simple ones, and in that even complicated enough to use all the computer power which there was at the beginning. So we had codes which worked for elliptic problems. And then, of course, it's kind of the nearest thing to do to use this code for the elliptic problem and just build something which is like solving ordinary differential equation. And on each time step, you just use the code for the elliptic problem to solve that. It's much more easy than to start from the very beginning and write code for parabolic equations which treat space and time just as variables of the different ones of variables. So this might be also a factor of history, yeah, that we really like to use parabolic equations very often in this way of looking at it as an evolutionary thing, where at each time step we have to solve this elliptic problem and can use the numerical schemes which you know from ordinary differential equations to do that. Okay, then the second thing, sorry, my second main observation here is that, of course, firstly, mathematically speaking, but also from a physical point of view, it's really interesting to consider, interesting to see what's happening for t going to infinity. And of course, from our everyday observation, we know that if at the very beginning we had a temperature difference and we just leave the system to its own devices, don't interfere with it, we just have to give it enough time and then the temperature distribution is the same everywhere. So if the model is good, we should really see that for long enough time. And so this is just a way to giving it long enough time intervals. There should not be any change in the temperature, which means that we have only one part of the equation, which is that the Laplacian of T should be equal to zero in our domain omega plus boundary conditions. And I dropped the kappa because here we have zero, and so it has to be really fulfilled by the Laplacian and not by anything which is related to our material constant kappa. And of course, this is an elliptic problem, and it's called a Laplace equation. And this is kind of, if we come from this physical process, this is the equilibrium endpoint of our process, which is prescribed by the solution of this Laplacian of T is equal to zero. Okay. Maybe I just give one last mathematical point, our heat equation has an analytic solution. If we consider it in without boundary, so in R3, I won't put it on the blackboard because it takes a lot of time, but it's you find it in the script, and it's an exponential function which decays with kappa, and it's multiplied with sinus functions in all space directions, so x, y, and z, or x1, x2, x3, however you want to call it. And of course, this is useful, because then what you can try to do is you use this solution which you have in the whole space, try to combine it with what you have as local information. So just to try to build your bounded domain omega in which you want to consider the temperature distribution as cutting off R3. As has to be expected from the physical point of view, of course, also mathematically, the most difficult part then is what you do with the boundary values. You have to introduce them into this process in order to have a theory which says how smooth the solutions of the problem can be. Concerning the numerical schemes, of course, there is an invitation to just use different schemes, so just replacing all the derivatives which are there by a difference quotient, and then stop this limiting process which makes a differential from this difference quotient for some numerical value h is usually, which is not zero but a bit larger than zero but small nevertheless. And the good thing with parabolic equation is that they really have a smoothing property. So if you have something which is non-smooth at the very beginning, it gets smoother through the equation. And so we benefit from that and can really use these kind of naive, simple numerical schemes. And on the other hand, they lend themselves to the numerical schemes which I was already referring to, coming from elliptic problems, of course, where you also have the possibility to just replace derivatives with finite differences. But we also have more involved numerical schemes like finite elements, which are very much related to elliptic problems and can use these finite element schemes in order to solve this Laplacian part of the equation and then start with an initial distribution and go a small step in time and taking this with a numerical scheme which is related to ordinary differential equations. So for example, Euler, which is just taking this different scheme for the differential in time, or if we want to have it more stable, we can take backward Euler, so which is just, you know, the time pointing in the other direction, or all kinds of numerical schemes which were developed for having stable solvers for ordinary differential equations. Okay. What's kind of a very nice for me in this part of the lecture is that we really start from observations, as we, for example, also did in our traffic models, which are kind of simple observations. And you know, these are observations which you can talk about with children, with people not interested in science at all, and they will all say, yes, that's true. And then ending up with a complicated object like a partial differential equation. Of course, here, taking all the material constants as homogeneous as possible, it's still kind of the simplest example of the corresponding partial differential equations. But nevertheless, on all these steps, you have a direct relation between the simplifications and kind of general assumptions you do on the physical side and on the mathematical side. So there's really a good relation between mathematics and physics here, at least, you know, in my point of view. And I hope I was able to convince you about that with my lecture today. So thank you for your attention, and no questions today. Maybe you have questions after the lecture.